You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after a few decades of falling out of favor, sewing is making a comeback. We'll talk to two experts about why it's important to them, and you can join the conversation. Now, the Big Ten Conference will be playing football this fall after a unanimous vote from its Council of Presidents and Chancellors. On August 11th, that same group had voted to postpone all fall sports. Several other major conferences had already decided to go ahead with their games. A group of Big Ten officials, including UW Athletic Director Barry Alvarez, outlined plans today for an abbreviated season starting on October 23rd. They also talked about a testing program for players and personnel, as well as standards for halting activities on the field. Colton Bartholomew is the Badgers football reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Colton, good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
Can you talk about what these stakeholders had to say about why now they're deciding they can go ahead and play where they weren't so sure up to as recently as last week?
Right. So the big thing was securing the daily rapid testing that they're going to have for COVID-19. It's an antigen test. And if anybody tests positive with an antigen test, they'll then take a PCR test, a nasal swab, and to be able to confirm or see if it may have been a false positive. So having the daily option there, that really decreases the strain of contact tracing efforts that they needed to do with these athletes was a big part of it. And then also the protocols that they put in place with a 21-day quarantine, at least for anyone that tests positive. And some other factors, including the myocarditis screening that they're going to be doing, an enhanced cardiac screening for anyone that tests positive as well. So they feel like the concerns that they had a few weeks ago when they voted in April or in August to cancel the season have been, allayed, and they're ready to play in about a month here once they get everything, all their processes kind of up to speed.
UW's Athletic Director Barry Alvarez took part in a virtual press conference today, outlined some of the plans. One key thing for Badger fans, they should not be queuing up online to buy their tickets, right?
They should not. No, no tickets are going to be sold to the public throughout the conference, actually. Only family members, and I think it's just going to be limited to parents of players and the coaching staff are going to be allowed in the stadium. And that really covers two big things. Is one, these programs don't want a lot of outside people coming onto campus unnecessarily, and they determine that a football game is not quite a necessary reason to come onto campus right now, given what's happening. And then two, some schools, like I know Nebraska is already upset that they won't be able to have fans. But if they were going to have a couple of schools that weren't going to bring fans in, they wanted to make an even playing field for everyone. So no public tickets, and we've already seen what they've done with the season tickets where there can be a donation or roll over to next year. So no public tickets, and going to be kind of a weird atmosphere when you watch a Badger game on TV with nobody in the stands.
Now, this comes after a weekend of NFL play, mostly with no fans in the stands, and some other college conferences in action. Do you think that the Big Ten leaders were kind of looking to see what happened over the weekend before they made this call?
I think maybe a little bit, but the wheels are already in motion starting middle of last week. A mid-October return was more possible than they originally thought. And then I also think that the access to the rapid testing has really increased in the last few weeks. And that, I think, was kind of a straw that broke the camel's back here, in that they can know every single day where they stand as a team and quickly isolate and start treating anybody that might catch this virus. So I think that it was more getting these tests and making sure that they're going to be available to them throughout the year. So now they can kind of start preparing to have a season and potentially, hope, I guess the hope would be to have it without hitches here.
Talking to Colton Bartholomew, Badger football reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about this new decision now from the Big Ten saying yes to football starting later in October. A lot of comments on our Facebook page. Let's let our listeners drive the show a little bit. Dave is one of the listeners who's happy about this. He says, "I'm happy for the players, and I pray for no positives positive tests, like what's been going on at campuses and other schools. Dave, bringing up the players now, if you're a football player, you're hoping to play football. Have you heard much from Badger players, like we've heard from some other schools, about what they think about whether they should be playing?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of excitement, and there was a lot of frustration when the season was canceled. Because the Badger players kind of felt like we've been doing everything we're supposed to. We're doing everything that you asked us to. But then you're not giving us a chance to kind of prove that right or make it worth it. And there was a lot of frustration a few weeks ago. And I think now that's replaced with optimism and happiness that they're able to play. And now it's kind of on them. We mentioned already the spikes on UW-Madison's campus is scary. And we're seeing where these dorms are quarantined and a couple other buildings are, you know, basically all quarantined areas as well. So it's really up to these student athletes to set the example on campus, avoid crowds, wear your masks, have good hygiene, things of that nature to stop this spread and, you know, continue to be vigilant in this so that a season can happen.
And Brian, on that note, writes on Facebook, completely irresponsible, no in-person classes at Madison, but it's fine to play football. Brian says this is total money over health. So, yeah, there is this weird discrepancy, no in-person classes as they're making this decision. What do you think of what Brian had to say?
He's not wrong. It's hard to argue that point. And the Big Ten officials that were on the press conference today kind of addressed that. They said, you know, we are aware of the optics of this, that we have these issues on campus right now, or on all these campuses right now, but are going to bring back football. I think a part of it is that they're going to wait about 5-6 weeks from now. So I think the idea is that some of these issues, these bigger spikes on campuses might be cleared up by then. But I think the other thing is that, in all honesty, that the athletes that have a little bit more on the line and have more, you know, juice in the game, essentially, and want to play football are going to be more responsible than the average college student that doesn't have that same type of incentive. So I think there's a fair argument to be made on both sides that maybe it's not a great idea, or maybe it's, you know, about the money. But then at the same time, I think that the athletes are the students that you worry a little bit less about, because, you know, they want to play and they're going to do what's necessary to play.
And Mary Jo writes, why not other fall sports? These athletes aren't good enough for these groundbreaking protocols. Mary Jo says, I guess money and politics talk when push comes to shove. So what's going on with other fall sports? And there's lots of them, Colton.
Sure. So the big thing about the rest of the fall sports is that the NCAA controls them, where the NCAA kind of gives way to the conferences and the college football playoff when it comes to football. And Kevin Warren, the Big Ten commissioner, said today during the press conference that the biggest thing about doing football first and getting football buttoned up, the way he put it, was that it's the largest teams on all these campuses, right? There's over 100 players, and then when you add in the coaches, there's about 150 people per campus that this affects. So getting that squared away, just because of the size of the teams and the extensiveness that these protocols are going to be tested, I think the idea is that kind of make football the test dummy, to use, you know, not the best analogy, but kind of use them as a guinea pig, make sure all these things work in these few weeks, and then bring back the rest of the fall sports. But the other part of it with fall sports is that the NCAA controlling their championships and having already moved, let's say, volleyball or soccer to the spring, there's not a ton of incentive right now for the players even or the programs to bring back these sports in the fall, when they don't have a championship or, you know, an end goal to be able to play for here in the fall. So I understand Mary Jo's point entirely that, you know, it should have been all sports. And I kind of agree with that. But the fact that football is still going to hold a championship here in the fall or the wintertime, technically, whereas some of these other fall sports have already been moved, that actually played a bigger role than I think the university's willingness to extend these protocols to all the teams.
Colton, in our last minute, I wanted to ask you, last time we talked to you, actually, what is it like for you being a sports reporter and having to capture the finer nuances of, you know, disease testing technology?
I'm not good at it. I'm not going to lie to you. I am much better at about talking about defenses and, you know, different run schemes and stuff like that in college football than trying to pretend I'm an epidemiologist. But we're hopefully getting through it. And I do think that I understand everyone's frustrations on both sides, and I think that having football back will be a good thing for the campus as a whole and for the community. So my big thing throughout all of this has been hopefully keep some people at work in the athletic department, in the communities, some of these other places that are connected to football that might have lost their jobs out of the season. So that's kind of where my mind's been.
Well, maybe next time we'll talk to you about X's and O's instead of R's. Colton, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Colton Bartholomew is the Badger football reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He talked to us about the Big Ten Conference deciding to play a shortened football season starting in late October. Coming up, Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail celebrates a special 40th this year. We'll find out about the Mammoth Hike Challenge that's part of the celebration. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how the Ice Age Trail is celebrating a 40-year milestone. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about discovering our place in the universe at Rib Mountain.
Author Jill Sisson Quinn likes spending time at Rib Mountain State Park outside Wausau. She recently took a hike there with her young son for a lesson about our place in the universe.
I want my 4-year-old son to climb a mountain. Not so easy in Wisconsin. Long ago, mountains as high as the Rockies covered the area, which is now our state. But today, I'll have to settle for 1,942-foot Rib Mountain. It's a remnant of that ancient Rocky-sized range buried by sediment, then revealed through erosion. I'm not concerned by the modest elevation because this mountain sports something more impressive. Its age. Rib Mountain contains some of the oldest rock in the world. At 1.7 billion years old, these rocks have been around for more than a third of the Earth's existence. We rub our hands across the striations on the side of a boulder, made by waves when the now quartzite was a river valley or ocean bottom. Long ago, this rock used to be sand, I say. I am awed by this evidence of the rock's previous forms, first sand, then sandstone, now quartzite. I tell my son to think about the ripples the ocean makes along the seashore. He gets it, looking around the heavily wooded mountaintop and responding, "There must not have been any trees here then." Next, I tell him the rock's age, knowing full well his understanding of such things still has a long way to go. His own number of fingers and toes, as yet a daily discovery. This window of not yet complete awareness of his own form might be a good time, I figure, to convince him of what we, like the rock, really are. The rock is old, I say to my son, but you and the rock are really the same age. Around 13.8 billion years old. The atoms in your body and the atoms in the rock made just after the birth of the universe and in exploding stars. You are stardust. Stardust, he repeats and smiles. He's heard me say it before. I want my son to take the long view, to think like a mountain even when he is not on the mountain, and not only about the earth, as Aldo Leopold imparted, but about himself. We should not get mired in how one strand of identity formulates us, but consider all the strands, the food we eat, the microbes we host, where we grow up, and the DNA we inherit, no more or less important than the atoms that make up all this stuff. I don't deny what we appreciate in the rock, its consistency of form, being itself, over such an unimaginable period of time. It's old, it's something. It has exactly the sort of permanence we ourselves desire. I come to the mountain today not only in a parent's feeble attempt to make my son seem immortal, but to help him better navigate life's journey, its hard facts, as well as its uncertainties. 100 years, the most humans can expect, is not much. Yet over that 100 years, our solid-seeming body is in constant change. Individual cells live from a few days to at most 10 years, continuously rebuilt from materials from our immediate environment. We are not sandstone, then quartzite for 1 billion years, or even human for 100. We are sea, land, and sky, all in one lifetime.
Jill Sisson Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, the Ice Age Trail stretches for over 1,000 miles through Wisconsin, and it's one of the state's most popular outdoor destinations. It's also celebrating its 40th anniversary as a national scenic trail. To celebrate, the Ice Age Trail Alliance is hosting the Mammoth Hike Challenge, letting hikers earn a commemorative patch by hiking 40 miles on the trail in October and supporting trail communities along the way. Amy Lord is Outreach and Education Manager for the Ice Age Trail Alliance. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Before we get to the challenge, tell us a little bit about this milestone, this 40-year anniversary.
Yeah, 2020 marks the 40th anniversary that the Ice Age Trail was officially designated a national scenic trail. The official signing took place in early October 1980, and so 40 years later, here we are as one of only 11 national scenic trails right now.
And tell us about this 40-mile challenge to celebrate.
Well, we kind of cooked up the idea earlier this year, actually during the Safer at Home time period, and we wanted to celebrate, and we knew people were hiking more than ever, and we wanted to do something that was safe and where people could hike responsibly, and so we came up with a challenge where people can do it on their own, they can do it with their family, and they can do it anywhere along the trail. And the other aspect is to be out supporting our trail communities at the same time.
And I want to make it clear, 40 miles, not necessarily all in one fell swoop, right?
Correct. this is something you can do at your own pace. We say you can do it in one big adventure. You can do it every single day of the month. You can do it in multiple weekends. It's really up to you how you want to get your 40 miles in during October.
And you don't have to be an experienced hiker to do this, especially if you carve it up into bite-sized pieces. Can you talk about some of the most accessible parts of the trail for people who might want, you know, not too rigorous a challenge?
No, you're absolutely right. We want this really to be fun. We want people to get out and explore. So it could be 2 miles that they're very familiar with and they do it over and over. It could be something where they go a little longer and, you know, 5-6 miles. It really doesn't matter, but lots of opportunity throughout the entire state of Wisconsin. So, you know, if somebody's thinking, hey, I just want to go out with, you know, maybe my kids or my partner and do 1 to 2 miles every couple days, you just tally those miles. So think about what you want to do, what works for you, and then kind of make a plan on how you want to do it, you know, how you want to do it throughout the entire month.
And you mentioned this is mainly about the hike, but also a way to encourage people to support some of the communities, the Ice Age Trail communities. What kind of things do you have in mind?
You bet. So right now we have 13 Ice Age Trail communities throughout the entire state of Wisconsin. And we are encouraging people to support any way they can. You know, maybe it's just getting gas within one of those communities, going to get carry out, having a bite to eat on the patio, going to the grocery store and getting snacks. So we know our local communities have had a financial impact with what's been going on. So we're just encouraging our hikers to, you know, support any way that they can. Every little dollar that they put into those communities, it's going to help. And so, again, it could be the cup of coffee, it could be ice cream, it could be gas, whatever it is, it's going to help those communities.
So if people want to sign up, get involved, and get that patch, how do they do it or find out more info?
Oh, you bet. We've got lots of information on our website, iceagetrail.org. It is free, so it's a free challenge, so you can register right there. We're going to ask you just a couple quick questions of where you're from and who's on your team. So you can do all of that on our website, and we've got a lot of really good questions and answers, because again, we want people to feel comfortable when they're doing this and know where they're going and how to do it. We've got a lot of good resources. We've got an interactive map. We've got a mobile app called Strive On that people can use. We've created some itineraries for each trail community, and just lots of tools for folks to look at. And you can find everything on our website, iceagetrail.org.
And Amy, in our last few moments, do you have your own hike planned out for October, or hikes, I guess?
I get to travel to some of the trail communities, so I'll give a little plug. We are, I am headed north the first weekend in October. I'll be in the St. Croix Falls area October 2nd and 3rd. So I will be hiking around St. Croix Falls at that time. I'm going to sneak over to Cornell on Sunday, October 4th. So I'll be doing a little hiking in Cornell. And then in Dane County, I'll be in Verona on October 10th, and I'll be in the Cross Plains area on October 11th. So I'm sure I'll be getting some hiking in there. Monty, the mammoth, our mascot, he'll be with me at those locations. So we'll have an opportunity for folks to come out and say hi to Monty and get their answers or get their questions answered, pick up some information about where they should go and how they should do it. So you can come out and see me and Monty at a few different places throughout October.
Amy, happy trails, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, and hope to see you on the trail.
That's Amy Lord with the Ice Age Trail Alliance talking about the trail's Mammoth Hike Challenge, celebrating its 40th anniversary as a national scenic trail. We have a link to info at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, September is National Sewing Month. We'll get advice and encouragement from our guests, and you can share your own experiences. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, find out how climate change and extreme weather affect bird species and about conservation efforts to help species at risk. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, it's National Sewing Month. A lot of things have happened in recent years to make sewing fall out of fashion, at least for some people. The home economic programs, a lot of them were cut in schools. Full-time work for both halves of a couple didn't leave a lot of time to make our own clothing, and these days it's pretty easy and cheap to buy clothes brand new. But the last 10 years or so have seen a comeback to the sewing world that seems to be driven in part by younger people, and the pandemic is driving a lot of interest this year. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like to sew in any capacity? Why do you do it? When did you start? Tell us about a project you've done or are doing right now. And has the pandemic led you to get into sewing for the first time or maybe back into it now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Belinda Banicki is the interim program director for the fashion and retail program at UW-Stout. She's also an experienced sewist. Belinda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Diane Dine has designed and written many sewing-related books, patterns, and articles for Nancy's Notions and worked closely with the Sewing with Nancy team. She's taught sewing, owned and operated her own fabric store, and worked in the sewing industry for decades. Diane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to hear both your origin stories, Diane, and let's start with you. When did you first start sewing?
Well, I started sewing in 4-H when I was about 10 years old. And the creativity that it nurtured gave, and the ability to create clothing that was unique and well-made is kind of what, you know, attracted me to that. I also got my Bachelor of Science degree in consumer ed at, or consumer science rather, at Stevens Point, UW Stevens Point. And the pattern design and fashion classes, textiles, tailoring, clothing workshops furthered my interest in it. So I was very happy when I was able to use my college education in doing something I loved as I taught consumer science at the high school level, and I had my own store, and I also worked with Nancy Zeman, as you mentioned, doing workshops and lectures around the United States.
And Belinda, how did you first, Dad, Belinda, how did you first get into sewing?
Yeah, I started when I was super young. I really wanted to make clothing for my dolls. So my mom taught me how to sew when I was like five. And yeah, I just kind of kept doing it. I really enjoyed it. It's a really great way to be able to kind of physically see something that's in your mind. And it's a fun pastime.
Diane, are you seeing maybe more people either get into sewing or back into sewing over the last few years, and especially in this pandemic year of 2020?
I definitely have seen an increase in sewing during the pandemic. I think the demand for sewing machines and sewing supplies has really been a lot, because, you know, people that are wanting to sew for this, I think they have more time to sew, and maybe others want to fix clothing that they have to save money.
And Belinda, Diane mentioned the creativity of sewing as something that appealed to her from the start. Talk about sewing as a creative outlet for people who may not think of it that way.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's such an easy way to start. So you really, you know, you can sew by hand. You don't need to have a machine. So it's something you can learn really easily. And then it's just so fun to be able to, you know, kind of think of an idea and then just be able to make it. I think, you know, you can also start from clothes that already exist and then add to them. So it's just like a really creative way to, you know, kind of be an individual and add things to your clothes. And, you know, I think a lot of, especially younger people, really kind of resonate with that and spend a lot of time doing it.
All right, Diane, here's a challenge for you, me. Since I was in elementary school, I have this magical thing where anything with scissors or drawing or cutting or anything like that, my fingers magically turn into thumbs. I can't do these things. Would there be hope for someone even as inept as me to learn how to sew and be able to do it and come out with something from it?
I think there would. I think you might have to have someone else cut out your patterns, but but I think you should be able to sew. A lot of the machines just about sew themselves these days. And I think that one of the things, just going back to what she mentioned as far as, you know, liking to make your own things, as far as Belinda mentioned, there's so much popularity now with the vintage and the thrift store clothing that I think that that's another thing that's brought people back to sewing clothing, because you can change, if you love the fabric of something, you can change the style features, or you can make it truly one of a kind by changing some of the techniques on the clothing.
And in doing some of those things, Belinda, do you see younger people taking interest in doing some of those projects, either making their own clothing or, as Diane was saying, taking that vintage stuff and making it fit?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I work with college students, and, you know, that generation specifically cares so much about like sustainability and reusing things and trying to reduce waste and things like that. And so I think that has been a big driver in like them wanting to sew more, because, you know, if a button falls off, they don't just have to get rid of it. They can sew it back on themselves, or, you know, they can buy something that has a hole in it and they can fix it instead of having to throw it away. So I think that's been like a huge thing specifically in that generation that has made them want to sew more.
Got two sewing experts with us for National Sewing Month, and a rise in interest in making and or fixing our own clothing and other material projects. Diane Dine is with us, worked a long time with the Sewing with Nancy team. She's been teaching this and judging it and everything, really. And Belinda Banicki from the Fashion Retail Program at UW-Stout. And with you, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234, call up with your sewing experiences and or questions. Let's go to your calls now. Lynn is with us in Stevens Point. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I'm calling from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and I've been sewing since I was about 4 years old. I learned on a treadle that eventually became converted into a kick wheel for making pottery. And I just, this past winter, my sweetheart revived his mother's sewing machine. She had 7 kids that she sewed all their clothes, and he learned how to sew this winter, so he's excited about that. I mean, I'm proud of him for picking, because he couldn't even sew a button.
Oh, that's good news for me, Lynn. Are you working on projects together, or are you kind of just helping him along?
No, he's kind of slacked off now because he's pretty busy at work, but okay. I'm retired, so I'm just doing some mending. But I used to make a living doing, I'd worked in sweatshops, but then I moved on to doing custom work and more creative endeavors, so artists, because I'm a fiber artist as well. So it's just like this gal was just talking about repurposing. It's so nice to see the young kids that are getting into it, you know, and just, it's such a meditate, you know, if you're not in a sweatshop situation, but in, you know, it's a meditation. It's just, you know, you're putting your thoughts on, it's like drawing. You're drawing with fabric.
Fantastic, Lynn. Thank you so much for sharing that. Well, Diane, for somebody like Lynn's sweetheart getting into it for the first time, if somebody out there is thinking they want to go from not sewing to sewing, how do you suggest they get started?
Well, I think the first thing is to make sure that you've got a machine that's running properly and that you read the manual and know how to use it. I think that's step number one. And then start with something simple to sew that doesn't involve any fitting. And I think just relax and have fun. I probably wouldn't have said this many years ago, but things don't have to be sewn perfectly, especially when you're sewing with young children, as I found out. Have good quality sewing supplies and use good quality fabric. I guess those are points that I would say are the best things for getting started.
And that's with a machine, Belinda. What if we wanted to work on some hand sewing as our first project, or is that a bad idea? I don't know.
I mean, I think it depends what you're doing and how good you want it to be. I mean, Diane's right. You know, having a really good machine is definitely your best bet. But there's so many resources out there, you know, online, and you can just, depending on what you want to do, you can find good resources for how to do it. So I just feel like if you want to do it, do it. You'll never know if you're good at it until you try it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lynn. We've got two guests with us now to talk about a growing interest in sewing during National Sewing Month. Belinda Banicki is the Interim Program Director for the Fashion and Retail Program at UW-Stout. Diane Dine has taught sewing for decades, still continues to do that on a freelance basis. A lot of experience in sewing on the air with us right now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you sew? If so, what got you into it and why do you do it? Tell us about your best ever project. Or are you just getting into it and you need some advice from the pros? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation here from more of you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a growing interest in sewing, especially during the pandemic. Two experienced sewing experts are with us, Belinda Banicki from UW-Stout, Diane Dine, longtime current sewing instructor, judge, fabric store owner, and much, much more. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your sewing experiences and your questions along the way. Let's go back to your calls now. Gail is with us in Superior. Gail, hello.
Hello. I think it's fabulous that everyone learns to sew, girls and boys, whatever. I'm from a family of, there was 10 kids in my family, and if I didn't learn to sew when I was in 4-H, when I was like in middle school, I didn't have things to wear. When I got married, I made my own wedding dress, attendance dresses, mother's dresses. I've moved on from there. I've done some quilts, pillowcases, you name it. Right now with the pandemic, I've made over 200 face masks that I just give away to family and stuff. But I'm also on the school board
in my area, and I wish more kids would be doing this and have more summer programs that kids could learn to sew. And it's just something that gives me pleasure and an accomplishment. And I'm thankful I started back when I was in 4-H.
Gail, thanks a lot for that call. And Diane, would you like to see more exposure to sewing at early ages, whether from parents or in home ec classes or as you did in 4-H?
Definitely. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter, and, well, actually she's older than that now. She started sewing when she was 3, but she's 5 now, and I have one that is 9 and one that is 8, and they all 3 of them sew, and they just really love it. So I think that it's good to expose them, you know, at a young age, and you know, they make projects that they're proud of, and it makes them feel good. It makes me feel good for teaching them. And I think it's a win-win.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Will with us now in Platteville. Will, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I picked up sewing again for the first time in 25 years to help finish up some masks. But a lot of my friends have sewn for a long time, back in high school with Renaissance fairs. And more recently, I was an anime nerd, and many of my friends would do cosplay. And so many of them would make their own costumes or accessories, steampunk type stuff. And now I even see some of my students do it in classes.
Will, fantastic. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Belinda, do you see that? People interested in making costumes, whether it's for Renaissance fairs, cosplay, where people dress in costumes, or maybe it's almost October, maybe with Halloween in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot of students who come in and their, you know, kind of end career goal would be costume design, or, you know, they'll show us their portfolio and it's all filled with costumes and things like that. It's definitely a much more popular market than I would have expected. But like you said, I mean, for Halloween, you know, you can make your own costumes, which is always really popular. Again, you know, taking stuff that's from thrift stores and then kind of altering it to make your own costume. It's definitely a really, really popular thing, especially in the college age.
Will, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. We're talking about a renewed interest in sewing. It's National Sewing Month right now. Two experts with us, Belinda Banicki and Diane Dine. Still time for your questions and experiences at 800-642-1234. We heard from Bruce in Bayfield, who called in to say, I have a sewing machine that was given to my parents at least 60 years ago. Where does one go to have a sewing machine checkup to get it in working order? Where would you point him toward, Diane?
Well, I would have him check, you know, local places that sell sewing machines, because many times they have someone there that fixes machines as well. Or look in your Yellow Pages or your Google it. You know, you can find a lot by Googling, and I think, you know, I found fabric stores and, you know, different for sewing machine parts and everything online. So, you know, you can definitely find them online or, you know, a lot of different avenues like that. But I would start with a reputable dealer.
And as I understand it, Belinda, Bruce should also have some patience. I understand during the pandemic, there are some pretty long waiting lists to get that old machine repaired. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have heard that too. I've had students who were trying to get machines for school that just started last week, and they're still kind of sold out everywhere. And, you know, I think everyone's at home. It's like a fun pastime to do. So, yeah, there's definitely a big backlog of machines at this point.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. When my grandma was alive, my dad's mom, we used to make quilts and how to put buttons on clothes and patches on pants and stuff. And I think that kids today need more of learning how to do that kind of stuff, because if you get a rip in your jeans and they're still good, you should be able to figure out how to put a patch on it and wear them. So that's my fondest memory.
And Samantha, are you still using these skills today?
Yes, I am. I wish I live in a little apartment, so I don't have a sewing machine, but I do, you know, find myself putting a button on if a button falls off, or, you know, mending stuff, you know, just hand. But yes.
Samantha, thanks a lot for calling on. I'm looking down on my shirt here where I just lost a second button. I can't really wear it in public till I do something about that. Thanks a lot for that call, Samantha, and for sharing that. What would you say to someone, Diane, who maybe had those early lessons as a kid or used to do it and wants to get back into it? Easy as getting back on that bike?
Yes, I think so. Some of the techniques might have changed, but yeah, I think that if they pick up their machine, they look in their manual, and you know, I think that they could start very easily.
Something. Thanks a lot again for calling in, Samantha. Something I wanted to ask both of you about. Let's start with you, Belinda. Do you feel like there's a community of people who sew, whether it's the subgroups of quilters or costume makers or what have you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, kind of what you just said, you know, quilting is such a big thing. There's quilting groups and things like that. I mean, I think, you know, anytime you find something that you love doing, like, you want to talk about it with people. So, you know, I think especially with like creating and sewing and, you know, there's always new techniques and new things you can do. And so being able to have like a community and a group of people who are into the same thing, it just helps you get better at it because they can kind of, you know, teach you what they know and you can teach them what you know. And plus, you know, it's fun to be proud of the things that you make and to kind of show them off and be around people who appreciate it.
And Diane, having been involved with the Sewing with Nancy team and owned a store, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess you've got some long-term friends you've made in the sewing community.
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, and, you know, Nancy's Notions is not open anymore, but some of them have, you know, are still doing Nancy's patterns, and, you know, she still has a website and whatever. So, yes, I still am connected with them.
Fantastic. Well, just in our last couple minutes or so, tell me a good starter project, assuming we can get our hands on a good sewing machine and have it working. Diane, where would I start?
Well, it depends on the interest level. With my grandkids, they loved sewing on fleece. They made hats and scarves and things for their 18-inch dolls, and those were all fun for them. Some people might enjoy making pillows. Those are very easy to make. Embroidery or quilting, if you have an embroidery machine, the kids seem to like that too. Although one of my older granddaughters said, you know, she was bored with embroidery because she said she didn't want to just sit and watch the machine do all the work. So she would get the embroidery started, and then I would take her to the regular machine and she would, you know, do some other sewing. So I think there's something for everyone. But pillows, pillowcases, some of the purse patterns are very easy, aprons, hats, scarves, that type of thing, or quilting.
All right. Well, and Belinda, give us a quick next step project before we let you go.
Yeah, I mean, she, you know, kind of covered some of the really good ones. I would say anything that has like a lot of straight lines, you know, is easy to follow. You don't have to do a lot of curves, things like that. That's where you start.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Belinda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Diane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Diane Dine. She's designed and written many sewing-related books, patterns, and articles for Nancy's Notions and worked closely with the Sewing with Nancy team. She has taught sewing, owned and operated her own fabric store, and worked in the sewing industry for decades. Also with us, Belinda Banicki, Interim Program Director for the Fashion and Retail Program at UW-Stout. A longtime sewist herself. We talked about the rise in popularity of sewing in the last decade in honor of September being National Sewing Month. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a lot of kids are learning online, and a lot of parents are trying to help them, or at least to stay out of their way. A guest from Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction joins the show with some advice for the parents and their kids. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and from Wisconsin Public Radio. Then our next guest explains why she says systemic police racism in the U.S. is mostly a myth when she breaks down the data. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.